Hello, my name is Yarmo. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Yarmo.
There's quite a lot of people to be speaking to without having a drink first. Wow. In the old days, I really could not do that. I used to be a performing artist, a musician. I was in this business called jazz music. I was a trumpet player. I could not perform sober. If I tried to, I was shaking, trembling, getting into a depression, and I just could not do that. If I was being asked to speak to any number of people, being it a group of students in school, I'm teaching in the music academy, I could not do it sober. I was just feeling awful. And now, thanks to this program, I can say whenever I'm being invited to any opportunity to speak, I can say yes, and I really mean it, because I am always looking forward to. And of course I'm nervous, but nowadays I allow myself to be nervous. It's okay, it's normal, it's just human. This is really beautiful. So many alcoholics waking up sober without a hangover on a Sunday morning. How did it feel?
Great. Good.
I felt like shit. And I feel like shit every morning. I'm 7.5 years sober, clean and sober, and I still feel like shit every morning. So you're not the only one who's suffering from this. And I know by now that this is God's message to me. Yarmo, you haven't been drinking in 7.5 years, but you're still an alcoholic. You get up out of your lazy bed, start praying and meditating. So, in fact, I learned to see this as a blessing, because I've seen so many people, after 1 or 2 weeks of sobriety, they looked glowing, smiling, they woke up with no problem whatsoever, and they just did not realize that they needed the program, and they relapsed, or even died. Some of you may have gotten it immediately, and I'm happy for you that it went like that. In my case, I have to work very, very, very hard for my emotional sobriety, because I am unique, you know. I'm different. I suffer from terminal uniqueness. However, nowadays, thank you very much. No ice, please. Nowadays, however, I'm able to say to myself, unique? Well, you know, all human beings in the world are unique. Except me. It's a difficult one, eh? I'm very grateful for the fact that many fellows realized that this is the first time I'm going to speak in a convention. I've been doing my life story in rehab clinics, and I've been speaking at meetings, but never at a convention yet. And there were people who were very kind to give me advice how to do this. Even yesterday I talked to two fellows. My sponsor, for example, I asked him, Nick, do you think, is this microphone working okay? The battery will be gone in 5 minutes. Well, I said, Nick, you think this is an AA fellowship. Do you think it would be harmful or inappropriate to share a little bit about other substances too, like cocaine, which was also a part of my journey? And he said, no, it's okay, you can absolutely do that. So if you don't agree, talk to Nick after that. And my dear friend Tom, yesterday, gave me some great advice. Yesterday evening, he came to me and he said, Yarmo, don't screw up tomorrow. That's to France and foreign. I would like to confess something to you. I have been secretly wishing over the last few years, when I was attending this convention, that okay, one day, perhaps when I'm ready, when time is right, I would love to share at the convention. And I thought, well, I could make it clear to the organizing committee that, hey, I'm interested. But instead I decided to think, well, when time is right, when God decides so, it will happen. And if it doesn't happen, it's okay. And when I received this invitation like half a year ago, I thought, wow, sooner than I expected. Absolutely. I'm very, very, very happy, very honored by this invitation. I still have no clue what I will be talking about, but but grateful I am. Well, this hour passed by quickly. I can still see you coming in. one more confession before I start to share how I got here. 2 weeks ago, I decided that when I'm going to speak at this convention, I want to be clean from caffeine as well, because in my situation, it would seem like cheating if I would be standing here with an incredible load of caffeine in my body. As some of you know, I can obsess pretty much with caffeine as well. I mean, I have an obsessive character anyway, but caffeine is one of the things that came after I stopped drinking, because I was still looking for that buzz. And I can drink a couple of cups of coffee, and then I start to, my mood starts to get better. I get really uplifted, and then I drink more, and I drink more, and I drink more. And in the evening, I'm completely spaced out from caffeine. Completely spaced out. And then I don't sleep. And the next morning, the cycle repeats again and again and again and again. I mean, in a way, it's great that caffeine is not on the list of forbidden mind-altering substances in this fellowship. Because if it was, then I would have ended up on the electric chair already. But I'm happy I was able to do this. And I tell you, it was difficult. It was absolutely one day at a time. 2 weeks ago, I stopped drinking caffeine and I got a headache that lasted for 5-6 days. And there was no amount of painkillers that would do anything about that. After that, I thought, okay, now the headache is over. Now the fun part starts. And guess what? I started to get the hot and cold sweats. I couldn't sleep anymore. My nose started dripping. All my joints and muscles and bones, everything started to hurt. And I thought, damn, 7.5 years in recovery, picking up the chip each year, and I'm right in the middle of a detox here. Incredible. Okay. How did I get here? I was born, to begin with. It seems like a lot longer, but it was 49 years ago. It feels like a lot longer. 49 years ago into a family where there was a lot of fun. My father was, his profession doesn't really matter, but on the side he liked to be a stand-up comedian. And he did this very well. And he was very full of humor. And he liked to drink. Not as alcoholically as we have done, but he was really a great example to me, because after he had had a drink, man, it was killing. His sense of humor, it was unbelievable. The way girls would adore him. The way he could talk in any situation, it was just unbelievable. And I thought, wow, this man is my hero. I had a nice, nice childhood until I was 10 years old. And I had already had my first drink when I was 9. My father took me to a bar and he was talking to his friends. And I was having fun with his friends. And at a certain moment, I thought, I'm going to order myself a beer as well, because these people are so nice and friendly, and my father was not strict on me at all. Not anyway, but certainly not after an amount of drinks. So I went to this bartender and I said, well, for all these fellows, beer and blah, blah, blah. So I ordered one beer more for me. I was 9 years old. And I still remember that smell, that taste. That was the first thing I loved about it. The smell, the taste, wow, it just killed me. It was wonderful. It was like the thing I had been looking forward to. And I was 9 years old, and I was absolutely not an unhappy child until that moment. Until the age of nine, I mean. And then I discovered that, and I thought, I'm going to do this every day of my life. My father said, after two beers, he saw it happen. He said, okay, son, this is enough. This is, you have had two beers now, you know what it tastes like. And he had no idea what this thing had started. I would outdrink him very, very soon when I was 12, 13 years old. I had my first serious hangover when I was 10. I still remember. I went with my father to, what was it, the 75th anniversary of the local brass band of this in this little town where I was born. And I drank something like 8, 9, 10 beers. And when we came home, I started to throw up, and I had my first very serious hangover the next morning. And I can still hear my father and mother quarreling about it in the kitchen. And I hear my father say, yeah, I told him, don't drink so much Coca-Cola, it's going to make you sick. And my father was always defending, always rationalizing the thing. He said, he is doing well in school. I'm not so worried about this. It's going to be okay. And my mother, who is not a drinker at all, has never been. She said, I heard her say when I was 16, she said to my father, this kid is going to be an alcoholic. Who is going to take care of him if things are really going wrong? And I thought, ah, my mother again, worried about everything. But she was right. I turned into a heavy alcoholic. Well, I believe I was born an alcoholic, but things went downhill quite soon. In the meantime, however, when I was 10, soon after I had visited this party of the local brass band, I picked up the trumpet. I wanted to learn jazz music. I loved jazz music from the age of 6. And I picked up the trumpet. It went very well. I practiced very hard. I was very obsessive practicer. If I had finished my homework for school, or even before I did my homework for school, I was practicing the trumpet and I was playing along with jazz records, and nobody around me understood a thing about jazz. So it made me feel alone. And in a way, I thought, I'm going to show everyone that I am doing something great that normally kids at this age cannot do. So very soon, I got into a local band. It was a funk band. Funk music, and very soon I got into a Latin band with people from the Antilles, Suriname, and things like that. And I started to do gigs while I was still in high school. And of course, you can guess what happened. The next morning after a gig, I could hardly go to school. I would be in school with a huge hangover if it was during week time. If I was going to a rehearsal of this brass band that I was also playing in on a Thursday night, I would always be with a hangover in school on Friday. And my mother was so concerned. And every time when she started to cry about it, I said, Mom, this was the assignment for geometry or whatever. I've got a 10 again. I got a 9 again. What are you worrying about? I'm doing okay. Don't worry. Stop bothering about it. And by the way, now that I think about it, we had a little group of friends in school, four guys. And the four of us, we would drink a lot. We would party. We talked about alcohol all the time. We found it utterly important. And we always had the highest possible marks on a scale from 1 to 10. If you scored below a 9, then you really had to explain something the next morning to this group. We were perfectionists. We were obsessive. Now, 30 years later, one of them is dead. Jumped out of his window on a millennium night, killed himself. I nearly killed myself, but I'm here. And there's two of this group who have happy families and did not turn out to become unhappy drinkers. So already then, something was happening that should have warned me. But of course, whatever terrible things happened, it wouldn't make me stop anyway. Okay, so I was 18 years old. I graduated with a nice report. I moved to The Hague. I went to the conservatory to study jazz music. I was doing very well at the time. My teachers, they liked to drink. Fellow students just moved out of the house of their parents. They all started to drink. They all started to date the girls, boys and girls together. Big parties, drinking, missing lessons, things like that. And 6 years later, I graduated with a 9 cum laude. Sometimes I say cum fraude. Because I was very drunk on my final exam concert. And I heard afterwards, the jury was having a debate about what mark they were going to give me. And the chairperson of this meeting was the only not jazz musician, he was a classical musician. And he said, gentlemen, I don't know, should we accept the fact that the candidate for his final exam is drunk on stage? Then one teacher said, a very well-known Dutch piano player, he said, you know what I'll do? Here's my paper, I'll put a 10 on it, and I see you at the bar. So I got away with almost anything. I mean, no problems, no terrible consequences so far. But my drinking got out of hand. And I did lots of gigs. I did a lot of touring through Europe. I went to the United States a couple of times. Sometimes I managed to stay a couple of weeks sober, sometimes even a month. Sometimes I managed to be in charge of the whole band, being the road manager. Sometimes I managed to do that. I wasn't happy on the stage, but sometimes I thought, well, somebody needs to take care of the whole situations. I remember sometimes I needed to talk to an airline company. I needed to talk my ass off to get this band on the plane, completely drunk, except me. And I said, guys, don't ever do this to me, because this is terrible. Having to deal with 8 persons, having to get them on the plane, and I'm like babysitting you. Guess what? That same evening, I relapsed. And the next morning, when the whole band had to be on an airplane, 6 in the morning, it was me who had to be picked up from my bedroom completely upside down. So these kind of things happen all the time. Very slowly, things were going downhill, 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 until at a certain moment, I discovered also cocaine. And the combination of alcohol and cocaine, well, that really did it for me. It dragged me down in an enormous tempo. I did things very soon that I had never expected I would ever do. I was usually quite strict on time. I usually played well. Most of the time I played well. After this adventure, however, I did not show up sometimes for my own concerts. I did not show up sometimes in school. I would call in sick, or I would call a fellow musician and I said, I can't make it to school. Can you teach my students today? And if I was lucky, the person on the other end of the phone would say, yes, I will do that. If I was unlucky, he or she would say, I have a hangover too. call somebody else. And it's a miracle, but I don't know if it is really something good. I still don't understand how it could happen that I never got fired from any job, from any band, from school, from teaching. I was sometimes teaching, bringing 2 half-liters of Spa Blau, but in it was vodka. So I just finished a whole bottle of vodka, gram of cocaine in my back pocket. And I just went home and I thought, well, I did it again. It's okay, nobody complained. And the next morning, the same thing. And the next morning, the same thing. But after so many days of no sleep, you just collapse and you don't show up. So around a quarter of the time, I was not showing up. And I got downhill very, very fast. Mentally, I was just destroyed at a certain moment. And I couldn't do it anymore, and I did not know how to get out of this adventure. how to get out of it alive. I had seen lots of therapists, lots of addiction workers, all not related to AA, to the 12-step program. They generally did their best to help me. I did my best. I tried to be as honest as I could, and it just did not work. It never worked. It absolutely never worked. One morning, I had not shown up for 3 weeks anywhere, and I woke up with the sound of the police knocking in my front door. And I went to the front door. I said, "What is going on?" They said, "Well, your friends phoned me because they haven't seen you in 3 weeks. You haven't been at work." And they said, "We advise you to seek professional help as soon as you can because you seem to have a problem." And believe it or not, I said, "You are right." I looked like terrible. I had blood everywhere. I had been throwing up everywhere. There was food everywhere. Cockroaches, mice. There were thousands of pieces of broken glass on the bottom of my feet. It was hurting like hell. I had burnt myself with boiling water that I had dropped on my feet or my legs. It was just terrible. And I said, "Sir, thank you very much. When it is 9 o'clock in the morning, I will phone a rehab." And I knew already which rehab I was going to phone. A 12-step rehab. I had a little folder. I had that already in my home for quite a while. And it had this logo on it. And it said, "Let go, let God." This was quite something to digest for somebody who was quite an atheist. On the other hand, I said to myself, well, any other way never worked. So what the hell? Why not? I phoned up this clinic exactly at 9 o'clock in the morning. Normally I would be at the liquor store at 9 o'clock in the morning. But this time I said to myself, I promised myself 9 o'clock exactly I will phone them. And I said, "My name is Jarmo. I'm completely drunk, but I hope you won't hang up the phone on me." And guess what? They didn't. They did not hang up the phone on me. And they said, "Well, it seems like you can talk, so what can we do for you?" And very soon, we had set an appointment for an intake. Off I went abroad to this clinic. And yeah, this is how the journey started. And before I was in this clinic, this lady who did the intake with me, she said, "The best piece of advice I can give you, go to an AA meeting every day." And I said, "Well, do I really have to?" She said, "Yeah, try it. Just try it. Give it a try." I walked into this meeting in the American church on a Monday evening. And I walked in, and it really felt like coming home. I know that a lot of you were absolutely terrified going to the first meeting. To be honest, I wasn't really. I walked in, I saw all these happy faces, and I thought, this is it. This is going to work. I still needed to endure one more relapse, but nevertheless, I knew that this was going to work, and I had a ball going to these meetings for 3 weeks, every night in succession, before I went to this clinic. So after 3 weeks, I was 3 weeks sober, I felt great, I was looking good, going back to the gym again, went to the solarium, looking okay, put on a nice suit, went to this clinic, and I thought, wow, after a month or 1.5 months, I will be completely okay. So I went there, I had a ball. It was absolutely, I was in a pink cloud, I didn't understand that. I had never been, not in a long time had I been sober for 6 weeks. I had a ball. We were going to these meetings there, and we were joking, laughing, everything. And we were, people showed us how to work the steps, the first 5 steps within the first 6 weeks. I had no problem whatsoever doing this first step, fourth step. I heard everyone like, "Oh, the fourth step, this is going to be scary," and they were putting it off, postponing it. I took a piece of paper, I filled it in. These are the 4 people that I could kill because I'm very angry at them. These are the people that were hurt by my actions, and these are my fears. And I wrote these columns, and in 20 minutes I went back to the therapist. I said, "This is it." And the therapist said, "Well, if you did your honest best and and she had a look at it and she said, well, it looks okay. This is your fourth stent for now. So I was done in one day. Very soon after I did the fifth step, and everyone told me, this is going to be scaring and whatever. Well, I had a ball talking with this person about the fifth step. We had a great ball. It was absolutely fantastic. So I was flying through this program. Then, after 3 weeks, which meant that I had been sober for 6 weeks altogether, then the pink cloud went. And that was difficult. Whoa, there was so much anger in me. There was so much fear in me. There was so much depression in me. I just could not believe it. I thought, well, I started so well. I worked my ass off, did all these steps and everything. And everyone was very satisfied about my working attitude. And now I get this, completely depressed. So they said, well, yeah, we think you better stay here a little longer in this extended care unit. And I immediately said, I will stay. I had wanted to continue working again, go back to Holland and resume working. But I said, no, like this, I can't go anywhere. So I stayed for a couple of more months. And I was going up and down, emotional roller coaster. I did the steps again. The second time I did the fourth step was already quite a bit longer, because suddenly I remembered more items, more issues. On the pink cloud, I just had not remembered everything. I remembered some people that I was really angry at, but there were many more. I remembered more people that I had hurt. I didn't remember those when I was on my pink cloud. So when this adventure was finished, everyone agreed that Jarmo is ready. He can go home now. He's okay. I had stabilized quite a bit. So I went home, expecting to go back to work. I arrived at home. I opened the door and I saw all this mess that I had left there. Broken glass everywhere. I put down my suitcase and I said to myself, this is not going to work. And I just collapsed into one of the most terrible depressions that I've ever had, and certainly while being sober. And I was so incredibly disappointed. I had never expected this. I went to a meeting every night, because during daytime I had nothing to do. My employer had said, Jarmo, take your time. You don't need to be back at work right away now. Take your time. So I took my time. 1.5 months or something. I was smoking cigarettes, insane amounts of cigarettes. I was drinking coffee all day, and I was lying on the couch looking at my watch. When can I go to this meeting? The meetings were the only thing I was living for at the moment. And the meetings are, of course, great. We need those. I needed those. And it was the only moment of the day that I felt more or less okay and at ease. But if the meetings are really the only thing in life that do still count, then you're doing something wrong. Or maybe it's still too early in sobriety. And I just could not accept the fact that I was so depressed. And I shared, because they had told me, if you don't feel well, share it in the meeting. So I started to sharing that, hey people, I love being here, but I'm very depressed and I've never felt so empty in my life. People started telling me, Jarmo, it's okay, don't worry, don't be in a hurry, but have you got a sponsor? I said, well, I just worked these steps 2 times, just until last week in the rehab. Can I have a little break with these steps, please? I was reading the steps at home. I was reading a lot of literature. I was praying. I was meditating, for what it was worth at that time with such a messed up head. But I just couldn't get it. After 3 weeks, it was New Year's Eve, and I thought, I don't want to be alone tonight, because that is too much to handle. So I was in a meeting, of course, also on New Year's Eve, and I asked around. I said, please, do you know a place where I can celebrate New Year's Eve? Perhaps in your place? One person said, you're very welcome, but New Year's Eve is for me nowadays like any ordinary day. I go to bed at 9 o'clock. So you're very welcome. Help yourself. There's lots of lemonade in the refrigerator and things to eat. but I'm going to bed at 9 o'clock. I thought, no, this is not it. I went to the next person, Edward. Maybe you know him from The Hague. He said, Jarmo, you're very, very welcome. But as you know, I usually go to bed quite early, also on a New Year's Eve. So you're very welcome. Help yourself. And I thought, no, I'm not going to do this. So that means that after 11 o'clock, I am again on my own. In a safe place, of course, but that was not what was counting to me. I found a friend who was not in recovery yet. But my best friend, who is 5.5 years sober today, or these days, and I said, could I maybe spend New Year's Eve in your place, because I'm desperately looking for company. I don't want to spend this evening alone. He said, well, that sounds like a good idea, because in that case, I won't drink and snort either. Would be good for me too. You're very welcome. I went over to his place an hour later, and guess what? He was completely uptight from cocaine and completely drunk. He had relapsed already in that hour. And I was stupid enough to enter that home and spend New Year's Eve with him. Of course, I should have said, well, this is your home. I'm not going to decide what you are going to do in your home, but I'm leaving. I'm going to call a sponsor, which I didn't have a sponsor at that time. I was not very responsible. I went in. And after a couple of hours, it was almost 12 o'clock, cocaine on the table and everything, I just relapsed. 3 weeks after coming back from this rehab. And this is really one of the most terrible things that could possibly happen to me. I was so ashamed. I felt terrible. Within one evening, I was on my same level of consuming substances and alcohol again. It lasted for 1 week, this binge. It could have been longer, but 1 week really did it. I was really completely destroyed. I phoned up Edward and I said, Edward, can I come and come to your house and try to stay sober today? He said, you're absolutely welcome. I went over to his home. I said, Edward, I haven't eaten very well in the last couple of days. Can I invite you to the Chinese? He said, yeah, okay, let's do that. We went over to the Chinese, and there I started ordering beer and Genever, and I was pounding them down like a madman. And Edward didn't say anything, and we were having conversations, and we were outside, and I thought he would take me to his home and put me to sleep or whatever. And he said, Jarmo, you're welcome to call me anytime, but when you're ready to stop drinking. So I was on my own again, and I felt so terrible. I went out on the streets and I began to ask around people, where can I find a gun? And people told me, I met several guys on the street. He said, yeah, if you give me 500 euros up front, I'll get you a gun. Well, I never saw that guy again. The next guy, almost the same story. I seem to attract people who knew that I was looking for something and that I had money on me. The next guy, I said, well, yeah, can I use your phone in your home and then I'll organize some things for you? Well, he organized all kinds of things except a gun. And by that time, there had been many criminal creatures in my home already. And at a certain moment, I thought, I need to get them all out, otherwise I'm totally fucked. Financially, whatever. This is not going to work. Nobody's going to bring me a gun to kill myself. So at a certain moment, I stood up. I said, please, everybody out. And they went. Incredible. They went. I got out of it alive. I had spent 1,000 euros probably, but I got out of it alive. So I found the person who is going to be my first sponsor. I said, Hans, can I please come to your home and try to stay sober for 12 hours or whatever, because I can't do the first bit alone. He said, come over. I went over to his home. He fixed me some food. He said, let me be your sponsor, because you are probably not going to ask anyone to sponsor you. And I said, thank you very much. I'm very, very happy. And he was my sponsor from that moment on. And things went better and better, and I started getting it. The first 4 years of my sobriety, however, were not easy. I was still going through emotional, how should I call it, depressions. I experimented with prescribed medication against depression, and this went on for something like 4 years. And it was very difficult. People kept telling me, well, you've been sober now for 1 year, don't be in such a hurry. A year later, they would tell me, you've been sober only for 2 years now, so don't worry too much about it, don't hurry. After 3 years, the same thing. After 4 years, the same thing. And I thought, hell, I'm not getting it at all. The obsession to take that first drink had gone, absolutely, it was out of my brain. But I was depressed very often. Then I went to an aftercare psychiatrist and I said, hey, can you please help me? I'm working this problem very hard. I've been clean and sober for 4 years now, but I'm not getting it emotionally. He said something that I will never forget. He said, it is my experience that around 20% of all the people who manage to stay clean and sober successfully keep being depressed. Because depressed means that there are things deep down inside in them that won't appear on their step four list because they are hidden too deep. He said, I'm not really in favor of talking and analyzing. And I was very relieved by that because I've done hundreds and hundreds of hours of that and it never helped me at all. He said, let's experiment with some medication. So I went on antidepressants, things like that. Did not really work. Did not hurt me either. Did not really work. Then I discovered something which is not really AA related, but I'm sure that some of you have been reading these books, these methods, so I don't think it will hurt if I mention these books to you. I've been doing a lot of work with Course in Miracles and with two of the books of Eckhart Tolle. And that suddenly woke me up. I suddenly understood what kind of tricks my mind had been trying to play on me successfully because I was still depressed. Finally, I understood, I mean, this is easier said than done. Finally, I understood that depression is only a thought. It is only a matter of learning to accept things and those kind of advices. And I found this very helpful. And until today, I'm working one lesson out, of course, in miracles every day. And this was this extra bit that I needed to do. I mean, 80% of you doesn't necessarily need this. Be happy with it. That's okay. But for those 20% who can't get the emotional sobriety, I would say try to find something a little extra too, on top of the meetings and the 12 steps and talking to your sponsor. Things like that. It really helped me. So the last 3 years for me went uphill and I'm okay. I'm really absolutely happy and I'm so grateful for the fact that I never gave up during these 4 years. I could have easily given up. I could have jumped out of the window, relapsed, whatsoever, and I didn't. I did not leave. I thought, if so many people can do this, I must be able to do it as well. And I managed to. First of all, by not giving up. Cheers. How did I stay sober? First of all, this how did I stay away from this first drink? I would like to share a couple of things with you, which it doesn't sound unfamiliar to you, but nevertheless, every morning when I wake up in this shitty mood, I start praying, meditating, ask for 24 hours of being clean and sober. I thank God again for the last 7.5 years, for the last day, for the day before, I mean. And please help me like you helped me. And I also say things to myself like, it would be disloyal to God not to trust that He will help me for the coming 24 hours. This is also something that really helped me. And I always ask for, send me somebody who might need my help. Send me somebody on my path, whom I could give a phone call, whom I could reach out to. I've been sponsoring quite a few people. And usually I don't share very much in meetings, but I always make it a habit to be talking to somebody whom I have heard sharing. And if something rings a bell with me and I think, I've got some advice for him, or maybe I could tell him that, find yourself a sponsor. In some moments I've told people, okay, you find it difficult to choose somebody to be your sponsor. Sounds familiar to me. Let me be your sponsor. Or a temporary sponsor. You can sack me again after a couple of weeks, but for the coming time, I'm willing to help you. If you want to come over to my house and we start working those steps, you are very welcome. Carrying the message, this of course relates to the topic of this meeting, this convention. There are a couple of things about carrying the message that I would like to explain it to you in parallels with music and with teaching music, because I'm a music teacher. About carrying the message, a friend of mine, a great European trumpet player, his name is Jörg, he went to have trumpet lessons with one of the trumpet greats, his name is Wynton Marsalis. He went to him, I said, can I have a lesson? Yeah, sure, come over to my house. They did a great lesson. Jörg paid him, and Wynton says, come back tomorrow. Jörg said, really? Come back tomorrow, same time. Jörg went back, received again a great lesson. He took out his wallet, and Wynton said, no, you don't need to pay me. Come back tomorrow. So Jörg goes back for the third time. Again a great lesson. Ready to pay Wynton, he said, and Wynton says, no. Later you pass this on to somebody else. Mm. Mm. Nice parallel with the program, huh? Mm. Yeah. Donald Byrd, great jazz trumpet player. He was teaching one of my colleagues, Eric Vloeimans, great trumpet player. I'm talking about 25, 30 years ago. After the lesson, he said to Eric, Eric, one more thing. Never, ever give up on any of your students, because you never know. Hmm. I try to see it like that in a fellowship as well. When I sponsor people or I see people, sometimes I tend to think, or I catch myself thinking, I really doubt if this person is going to make it. But we never know. Hmm. There's never a reason to give up. If the person is not making it, then at least we had the opportunity to reach out to somebody else. So I do my best never to give up at all. Never. We never know. Sometimes we see people getting it, and it had seemed so improbable that they got it. Sometimes you see people, you think, oh, they're really glowing, working these steps. And before you know, they have disappeared. So we never know what is going to help. A great drummer from New York, his name is Bobby Sanabria, from the Latin jazz kind of music. He was teaching the big band in our school. All the students had been rehearsing for a whole week, and the band sounded great. And on the dress rehearsal, the microphone rehearsal, the band started to play. Everyone was having a ball, playing great, except the bass player was getting lost. He got lost in his part, he couldn't cope, and the whole thing was falling apart. Bobby Sanabria, he stops the whole band. And I saw the face of this bass player thinking, oh, now he's going to blame me. Now I'm going to have a hard time. Guess what happens? Bobby looks at the drummer. He said, what kind of a musician are you? And the drummer says, well, did I play anything wrong? He said, no, you played everything right. I know that you are experienced. But your brother there was drowning and you didn't even notice? What kind of a musician are you? So, yeah, this big band is like a unit like AA. We stay sober. This stays a unit if we really care about the person who is not getting it yet. So I try to do my best to reach out to these people who are struggling. And one conclusion that I've been drawing from this is that there's never a single life lost in AA. And I mean, if somebody's not getting it, relapses and dies, it it was still a great thing that these people came to our fellowship. First of all, and I know this sounds ironical, I don't mean it ironically, they may show us how not to work the program. Secondly, to me it's very inspiring if somebody who is struggling and keeps relapsing keeps coming back all the time and is honest about what happened, is honest about what he or she thinks he was doing wrong. They show themselves in a very humble way. It takes a lot of courage to come back and to confess that you have been relapsing. I find this very inspiring. I find this very brave. And also, they give us the opportunity to stay sober ourselves. I mean, our friend Tim, who passed away half a year ago, I was with him here every convention for the last couple of years. He's not now with us any longer. The opportunities he gave me to help somebody who was struggling, I'm eternally grateful for that. I mean, without these kind of people, I wouldn't have stayed sober. I'm very sad that he didn't make it, but his life was not lost for AA. It was very important. And then finally, if somebody phones me up drunk, somebody who is familiar with the 12 steps or not familiar at all, I will always take the time to listen to somebody. I will never hang up the phone because I never know whether this is going to be the last time that somebody is ever going to pick up the phone anymore. And I'm always thinking back of this rehab facility. They said, okay, you're drunk, but we will listen to you. I wouldn't be here if they had said, call us back tomorrow when you're sober. Because the next day sober, I wouldn't have phoned them anymore. I would have thought, I can do this alone. So I will always listen to people on the phone who are drunk, and I do my best to direct them to a meeting. Or if the conversation takes too long or gets a bit out of hand or whatever, I say, you know what? 8 o'clock, see you at the meeting. Or I pick you up an hour before. Things like that. And I've seen people in the meetings who are clean and sober now. And they found me drunk. And I 12-stepped them, although they were completely drunk. So I'll never hang up the phone. All right. We have come now to something very important that you all have been looking forward to. I'm done. We are not a glum lot. It's okay to laugh. By the way, I said it before, but I find it a miracle that I can stand here and do this this share for you sober. I find it, I couldn't have done it in the past. This way, speaking in front of any audience or whatever, go on the stage to play my trumpet, was my ultimate relapse trigger. And nowadays, I can do speeches, I can teach, talk to a group of people, I can do it sober. I just am so grateful for that. Every morning, I write a gratitude list. Sometimes a long one, sometimes a short one. This helps me also getting into an emotionally stable mood. This is one of the things that I thank God for the opportunity to be invited to do anything for other people. I thank God for the fact that I'm not obsessing on alcohol and cocaine anymore. And I just thank God for that he made me find AA. And I'm absolutely thrilled whenever I get invitations to speak. This is very good for me because in the regular meetings, I don't speak of much. I still don't know why. But when I commit myself to an invitation that, hey, be there on this or that date, at this time you're going to speak, then at least I do it and I share what I have to say. So this is absolutely very helpful for my sobriety too. Okay. I think this was it. I'm finished. Thank you very much. And I would like to close with one more thing that I always find very helpful. Reality is for those who cannot handle alcohol. Thank you very much.